If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon. I'm Patrick McAndrew, and you're listening to Why Food, a show about people and their connection to food and drink. Now, the past seven episodes have been focused on food, but this week we're exploring the world of wine. This week I have Ali Shaper with me, the founder and winemaker of Brooklyn Oenology. Thank you for joining me today, Ali.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell the listeners what oenology is?
It is the art and science of winemaking.
Science is very deeply rooted in the company, isn't it?
Yeah, you could say so, yeah.
Because when we go back to your past, you had a past in engineering.
Yes, it's my wonderful, nerdy, geeky past.
Yeah, because I find that real interesting, because let's go back to the start of it, and then we can take the transition up to where how we came to Brooklyn Oenology.
Yeah.
So even before you studied engineering, did you grow up with food and wine? Was there a history of that in your family?
No, I was one of those like really fussy kids.
Were you really?
Yeah. It's kind of weird that I ended up in the food and beverage industry at all, because it was a pretty good chance that I was going to be pretty malnourished.
Was it just that you didn't want to eat that stuff and your parents were trying to say, come on, this is good for you, try this?
Well, I was just fussy, really fussy, yeah.
And what stage did you come out of your shell?
Probably about 25.
Really?
Yeah, I was just really picky for a long time. I don't know why or what it is. I'm still not the most adventurous eater, but I'm definitely eat a lot more than, you know, back in the day, if you will.
So growing up, was science the main thing in your mind, or was it how things work, or what was the area of engineering that drew you to it?
Well, it was a lot of familial influence, actually. So my father was an engineer, as was my grandfather, and there's just a lot of people in my family who were very math and sciences oriented, and I always was very curious about how things worked. I think my parents could probably tell you better, but as a kindergartner up through second grade, I think I've pulled out every book in the library about the planets, and I could recite to you the names of all the moons of Jupiter that we knew at the time. And, you know, I quickly memorized the order of the planets in the solar system and when the eclipse dates were going to be and all that, you know. But
and growing up at that stage in your life, what did you think? Did you think, I want to go into space? Did you?
My mom loves to tell the story that she said, what did she say to me? Something, you know, talking about, what do you want to be when you grow up and that kind of thing. And I said, I want to be an astronaut. And then she'd go, oh, boo, and pretend to cry. And I'd be, don't worry, mom, I'll be home in time for dinner. But I think a lot of that sort of, you know, space fantasy was also a lot about creativity and adventure. And I was a very artistic kid as well, and I spent a lot of time in music, and I'd spend hours entertaining myself drawing or putting together crafts. I think I taught myself to knit when I was about 10. You know, I just said, that looks fun. I had an aunt that would crochet, and I loved doing things with my hands, and so I always was dabbling in this stuff.
So was it the attraction to activity more so than the attraction to the analytical side of it?
Well, it's both. Yeah, I definitely have a really analytical side, but I also have a very strong, instinctive, creative side too. But you know, in the course of being guided by parents as to what to do, what to be when you grow up, you know, art and music look a lot less safe and stable than engineering does.
Definitely.
You know? So to me, as a teenager at the time, it made sense. You know, it's also what I was good at. And, you know, I also wanted to be able to make a living. And so, you know, for what I knew about myself at the time, I said, okay, engineering is the way to go.
So that brought you to Cornell?
Yeah.
And you did your 4 years at Cornell?
I did a lot of getting my butt kicked at Cornell, yes.
Really?
Well, it's a tough program. It's definitely a tough program. So,
And while you were there during the 4 years, because there's a lot of people that I've had on the show, and they would say that during those early days, they would look at it and think, yeah, this is good, or maybe it's easy, or there's an aspect to it that I enjoy. Or obviously the ultimate goal that a lot of people kind of look at in their early days is, well, this will make me money and this will be a career. But was there another side to you that thought, I don't know if this isn't allowing me to explore that other part of myself that I want to let out?
Yeah, there was that part, you know, but I did go into engineering school, you know, sort of with a design in mind, you know, because I was still interested in satellites, and I had space travel, or sending probes to planets, or even potentially actually becoming an astronaut. And so I saw this as an avenue to move in that direction. And then it wasn't until about, I guess it was close to my final year of college, and Cornell has a hotel school as well, and they have a large beverages program that you can focus on in the hotel school. And there's plenty of great colleagues of mine all around the city that have come out of that hotel program. And they do open up their, I'll call their Wines 101 class, to the entire university, so long as you're 21. And so, of course, you know, when all you're doing is statistics and mathematics and twisting your brain all day long, wine sounds like it's a pretty good break from everything else. And so it was really just, I chose it because it was such a different thing than what I was doing all day long, every day anyway. And it was an accidental discovery for me, because there was not wine on the table in my house growing up.
And during your 3 years or 4 years in Cornell, was wine your choice of drink?
Well, sometimes, amongst other things.
Was it drank to appreciate or drank for use?
Both. Part of the impetus of taking that class, too, was because, you know, there was wine around. So since Cornell is in the Finger Lakes, and Finger Lakes is one of the wine regions of New York, you know, it was around. And, of course, there's whatever else you can buy. But, you know, as far as that point where I said, maybe there's something else I want to do other than engineering, you know, that sort of planted the seed right there. You know, in the course of having to do the work for this class, you know, there were tastings every session, and and it touched upon most of the major wine producing countries and so on. So it was a pretty comprehensive overview, and it just really grabbed my imagination.
And when you looked at it and you went there, was it? Because I'm trying to think now what my first impression was the first time I was kind of introduced to wine when I went to a winery. And a lot of it went over my head, to be totally honest with you. But when you went there, were you looking at it kind of in that science mind, thinking, right, okay, I can get this. I can understand what the process is, or how this is all working to end up in the bottle and taste so good.
I didn't really think about that. It was about the sensory experience. It woke up reawakened that creative side to me.
So that ignited the fire.
Yeah, it sort of ignited the fire. And, you know, of course, when you take a class, they discuss about how it's made, and that was pretty straightforward for me to visualize.
Right.
But, you know, what drew me to it as a something that I love, as a beginning of a passion, was, there's this, first of all, it opened up a whole other way of viewing the world to me, because I was so very, you know, in analytical, and even though I was still doing creative things in other parts of my life, but as far as experiencing the world in the sense of, in the context of taste and smell, that was not my thing. You know, I was that person who, you know, I wanted chicken and I didn't want beef and I didn't want fish and da da da. You know, it's like, so all of a sudden there's this whole new flavor sensation. I went, wait a second, you know,
I like this.
That's why people liked you. Okay, I get it. You know?
And at what stage did you think, wow, I might pursue this. I might go for something in the wine world.
Probably not for another few years, really. You know, so I finished my engineering degree. I became a professional engineer.
What kind of stuff did you work on?
The first job out of school was with a company that produced global positioning systems devices. So mostly GPS devices for fleets of trucks. They're just getting into sort of the personal devices that you could take and go on hiking and things like that. So it was in those days when GPS was really starting to become commercialized, and it wasn't just used for the military. So I was working in their circuitry assembly unit, doing process engineering and quality control, and eventually got into sort of a more broad category called manufacturing engineering, which essentially means that you become a liaison between the designers and the production personnel, because sometimes the two teams don't talk. You know, there's a practicality to how you have to build something. But what a design engineer wants to do is fit all the features, as many as possible, as close together and in an interesting looking box. But then when it comes down to machinery that's available, or whether a human hand has to get in there, or whether somebody has to be able to see around, you know, one part to look at another part to make sure it's put together properly, you know, those two parties don't always speak the same language and think the same way. So I was that person in between that was the diplomat.
And how did you feel when you were doing all that work?
I really enjoyed it a lot, because that's just how my mind works. You know, it's kind of discipline where you have to be able to see the forest through the trees and see how all the spokes of the wheel make up the entire wheel. And so you're working with designers. You're not just working with electrical engineers, but mechanical engineers. And you're working with people who are managing the budgets and managing the whole project, because it's not just about building something well, but doing it efficiently in the context of both time and money, because those are essentially
great training to start off with in your early days in life.
Huge, huge training. And
you're learning so many core concepts of a business.
Yeah. You know, engineering is not just about running formulas. It's really about designing a system. And a lot of that is just very intuitive. And so, you know, this kind of study and this sort of work really sets you up as a way to think. And it's a kind of thinking that I've found extraordinarily useful in everything I do in life. So, you know, it's exactly the kind of thinking you need to, when you start imagining, okay, I want to make a product. Who's going to want it? How am I going to make it? Where am I going to find my pieces and parts? In this case, you know, where am I going to find grapes and bottles and corks and blah, 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 blah. How am I going to manage when they arrive, when I'm going to spend the money on them, and so on and so forth. So it's basically what this whole field is of manufacturing engineering is cohesion of all these variables and when they need to appear and when they need to interact in order to create a working system.
And during this time, was wine following you around? Were you testing?
Yes, it was like, you know, you got the shoulder angel and you got the shoulder devil, you know, and the shoulder angel is going, you can be really successful as an engineer and be really happy in life and live in a cubicle forever and have something really steady. And da, da, da. And then the little devil is going, let's go have some wine.
You know? And that's the fella you listen to.
Yeah. And it just couldn't flick it off. You
know? So when did you say, right, I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to go and follow the wine.
Well, he kept tugging on my earlobe, for crying out loud. So... yeah, after I graduated from school, I ended up in the Silicon Valley, and that's, of course, conveniently close to lots of wine regions. And the second job that I had out there had a schedule set up where it was such a great working schedule, and it was such a grand time to be working. Everything was booming. But they arranged it so that you had to work 9 hours every Monday through Thursday, and then 8 hours only every other Friday. So over 2 weeks, it'd be 80 hours, but you'd have every other Friday off. So I had a 3-day weekend every other weekend. So let's go to Big Sur. Let's go hiking. Let's go to the wine region. You know, so it just maintained as a hobby and just something I enjoyed doing. And, you know, during all this time, just really exploring taste, smell, flavor, and just soaking up whatever I could learn. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you found something when it's not an effort to learn something, when it just absorbs into every cell.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
You moved back to New York then to pursue it a bit further, did you?
Yeah, well, I didn't have that as the design in mind. It was more like I'm homesick and a little bit burnt out. And
where are you from in New York?
I grew up in Nassau County on Long Island. And yeah.
So in the end, you really brought it all back home.
I guess, yeah. Long Island keeps sucking me back in, you know.
So
as much as I keep trying to escape, it keeps sucking me back in.
So you came back here, yeah. You were a bit homesick, but you still mm-hmm. had this love for wine.
Yeah. I ended up, when I came back from California, I didn't go back to Long Island. I ended up in the Hudson Valley for a couple of years. And I really came back with no designs whatsoever. I knew I was not happy. I was not passionate about the lifestyle that I was living. You know, it's not like I didn't like engineering, but I didn't have that sense of getting up and jumping out of bed and being excited about going to do what I had to do. And I just, you know, I learned that I am no good in a cubicle. It constrains me. I feel trapped
I'm sure you share the same sentiment that so many other people do.
Yeah. I don't think human beings were designed to live in, you know, a fluorescent lit beehive, you know.
Right.
And it just, it really, I was depressed and I just had to leave. And, it was one of those times in life where I just had to make a stopgap and say, no, I have to figure out something else. And I didn't know what that something else was. So came home to New York, home-ish, since I wasn't at home. And literally sat on my butt for a few months going, oh, I don't know what to do. And, you know, you just start flipping through classifieds, you know, because I knew I needed to do something, but I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. And, you know, the next most obvious thing, of course, was to find another engineering job. But there were not nearly as many the opportunities for engineering on the East Coast than on the West Coast at the time. And so, you know, I basically had a choice of three different large companies, and it would essentially end up in the same place where that I left, you know. So I said, okay, I'll find something to do for fun for 6 months, give myself some breathing room, figure it out, and before I have to go and be a grown-up again. And it just was pure serendipity that one day, you know, after weeks and weeks searching through the classifieds, this is like opening up the newspaper before Craigslist days.
Circling what looks good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I still have the little ad somewhere.
Do you really?
Yeah, I have it in some, you know, memory box at home somewhere. And it was in literally the first line of this ad was, do you love wine? And I thought, why, yes, I do. <You know? laughs> It was an ad for a tasting room in at a winery in the Hudson Valley. And so that day I called up, got myself over there for an interview. And, you know, I tried to talk very enthusiastically about how much I love wine and all of that, because it's very hard to get your foot in the door and in the industry sometimes. And I think I got hired because I told them I'd build them a database to manage their wine club members.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you, because people do love wine, but it's a very daunting world to get into, because you almost feel like you have to be born into it, you know,
sometimes,
in some shape or form.
Yeah.
Being born into it, I mean that you worked in restaurants from a young age and you learned your way up, or your parents had a great knowledge of wine and they passed it down to you.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of connection. It's very rare that people develop it on their own terms and then find their way into the industry.
It's certainly not as common. I think it's becoming more and more common, but for sure, like, you know, just in the course of doing, running my own business and receiving resumes or requests for employment, you know, just inquiries as to whether there's job openings and whatnot. And, you know, many of them are, I just don't have any experience and I'm really interested to learn. And unfortunately, sometimes what I really need is someone who does have experience,
right,
you know. And so it is difficult to jump in. And I really think that, you know, I don't know to this day if that is the reason why I got hired, but I'm pretty sure it was a good, strong reason, you know, that I had some hook. I had some additional service to offer to this particular winery, and that's what got me in the door.
You didn't simply just have an interest.
Sure, there's lots of people who love wine, and, you know, when you get into wine, you know, of course, from the outside, it looks like it's all wonderful and it's very glamorous. But, you know, as we all know, in the food and beverage industry, it's a lot of late nights. It's a 24/7 job because it's hospitality, and it's never turned off. It's also can be very grueling work. You know, if you're a somm on the floor in New York City, you might be working until 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, it's restaurant work. It's a lot of late nights. Where if you just run any sort of food and beverage establishment, you're working late into the evening. You might be open 6, 7 days a week. You know, when you're in production, it's messy. It's a lot of physical work. It's long hours for extended period of time during harvest season. You know,
one thing I want to ask you is, because people, let me think of how I want to say it. So say, for example, now food.
Yeah.
Food is something that is a personal evolution throughout your life.
Yeah.
Because you have your set foundation of foods that you eat, or foods that you're used to, foods that you grew up with. And as you grow up, you're introduced to more things.
Mm-hmm.
So you can constantly build on that.
Yeah.
And then if you go into restaurants, if you wanted to, or anything like that, or you go out for a meal, I had something similar to this, I can build on and have something similar the next time. At what stage was it where you felt that your knowledge of wine clicked? And another question is, where is an easier place to find an understanding of wine? Because going out to restaurants and getting a bottle of wine and seeing if it works for you, it's kind of a hit or miss thing, because you're literally learning maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month. And it's hard to retain that, that palate of your wines.
Yeah, it's a thing that has to be practiced pretty continuously. And I think really the best way to do it, because there's the expensive way to do it, and that's to take all kinds of classes and whatnot. I think at the end of the day, there is a certain monetary investment that you have to put into it, because you have to taste, you have to smell and taste, because you can read all the books you want, but without the experiential knowledge, if you don't have the opportunity, you know, it's like trying to describe the color red when you've never seen the color red. You know, how do you do that?
Right.
So, you know, at one point or another, you'll have to spend some money on wine itself so you can taste. But some of the best ways to do that is to find great wine bars or other restaurants that have really good happy hour specials, or maybe they have a prefix special or a pairing special or something like that. So maybe you don't have to go out and buy a whole bottle, but you can get a glass of something. And maybe there's an opportunity if you go on a Monday or a Tuesday night when it's not a Friday and a Saturday, where there may be somebody who's there that you can actually ask questions, who may have some time.
Any spots you'd recommend in New York City?
To be quite honest, since I haven't been living in the city, I am not current.
Right, we'll scratch that one off the
list. Yeah, I need some advice on that, actually. I know a lot of places that I want to go that I haven't gotten to yet. So, or there is some really great reading to be had. And if you're willing to drop a few $100s on classes, I really loved the Wine and Spirits Education Trust of London courses. I did up to the advanced certificate level. And it's just comprehensive. It's a good functional class, really understanding wines, how they're made, wine regions. It's not as focused on service as is the Quarter of Sommeliers. But between those two bodies, you can get a very comprehensive knowledge of not of both specifically about wine and also of its proper service.
Wonderful. I'm going to take those tips for myself.
Yeah. International Culinary Center and ICE, they have some good courses as well. But I think, you know, for some experiential knowledge, if you find a couple of good spots and even a couple of good wine shops, you know, and don't, the thing is, I think the real key is to just not be afraid to ask questions. You know, for it's at least in our tasting room at Brooklyn Oenology, I've always wanted it to be comfortable where people can come ask questions, because after all, it is just it's a beverage. You know, it's not like we're curing cancer or doing something really grandly, you know, life saving and important here. You know, it's meant to be joyful and it's meant to be enjoyable. If you do it 3 times a day, it shouldn't be all that serious. I mean, yes, take it seriously and be look for quality. There's no reason not to have quality in your everyday food and beverage experience, but it's about fun and pleasure. So ask questions. Nobody is born knowing this stuff. And if somebody's giving you a hard time, well, find somebody nicer to ask.
Some great tips.
Ask me.
We are going to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to touch on the development of Brooklyn Oenology and the wine production procedures that you go through.
Sounds good.
And this one's called Walking Like a Cowboy by Talkstar. We'll be right back.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right, right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
Welcome back to Why Food. I'm here with Ali Shaper from Brooklyn Oenology. We just got some wonderful, wonderful tips on how to learn a little bit more about wine, and I've taken them all on a very personal level because I personally need to learn a lot more about wine. So, Ali, yeah. Mm-hmm. Brooklynology, it came along 6 years ago. Well, it came 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But the base itself in Williamsburg 6 years ago.
Yeah. So I got the company started in 2006 and started selling only through the wholesale channels in 2007. So literally, you know, running around with one of those sample bags and knocking on doors, making phone calls, that kind of thing. And then opened the tasting room in 2010. And, yeah, and 10 years have flown by.
And what was your vision when you set up Brooklynology?
Well, I was really excited about living in Brooklyn. And I came to live here because I thought it was just a really vibrant, creative community and surrounding not just the arts, but also the foods. You know, I moved into Brooklyn in 2005 and it was really just starting to percolate with the whole local food movement.
What part of Brooklyn did you move to?
I was in Carroll Gardens at the time. And then I eventually moved to Williamsburg. Yeah, that was in 2010 that I moved into Williamsburg. So I was in Carroll Gardens a little bit more than 5 years. And there are a couple of really great restaurants. There was The Grocery, there was Saul, and a couple other really great places who were sort of these leaders in farm to table in the local area. And, you know, and just everywhere you look, there was art. There was art everywhere. And it was literally just one day I was just strolling around in Red Hook and reading some of the placards there that described the history of the Beard Street warehouses and everything like that. And it was talking about their history as part of the waterfront and so on, and how now they're housing these small businesses. There was a parachute manufacturer and a glassblower and maybe a small marketing firm, and a couple other things. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me like, oh, you know, this is like a real transformation that's happening here. And I went, it would be so amazing to do a brand that speaks to this transformation, you know, this phenomenon happening in the community. Because the more I thought about it and the more I started looking around, that realizing, oh, we're, you know, it's switching from this heavy industrial history to this sort of new modern artisanal industry. And, you know, just all of a sudden all these thoughts came flooding in. I'm like, oh, yeah, of course there's Brooklyn Brewery. Yeah, you could totally do a beverage company here. Why not? You know, and sort of my idea was do it in the Beard Street warehouses. I didn't have the funds for that. So good thing Red Hook Winery did something out of it. So, and, but at the time, I wasn't quite ready to make the leap. I had been working in the wine industry for quite a while at the time. And I was still doing some, day job engineering as well. So, but it really colluded as this concept of celebrating, you know, what I now term, you know, Brooklyn terroir. And it's taking that idea of terroir in terms of, you know, the climate and the soil and where the grape is grown, but extending that definition to the sense of place as far as a community. So in the development of the brand of Brooklynology, the idea was to work with Brooklyn-based artists and pair modern contemporary pieces being made in Brooklyn right now with the wines that we produce. So, and use only grapes from New York. So really draw from these terrific agricultural resources that we have surrounding our state and surrounding New York City. And, you know, doing really great, well-crafted wines because wine, it should be. And, you know, to reflect that this sort of culinary renaissance that was happening in the borough, and then marry that up with the art scene that was here and have this line of wines be an expression of what it means to be a part of this world here in Brooklyn.
I consider it a very humane approach to wine.
Well, thanks. Yeah,
yeah, because you've stripped all the old world ostentatious displays out of wine and you've brought it to a much more approachable sense. The fact that you can peel off the stickers and you can look at it as a piece of art, you know.
Yeah.
You're looking at it from two sides, that what lies on the outside is just, well, it's not just as important, but what lies on the outside is crucial, mm-hmm. and so is what is on the inside.
I mean, certainly, you know, if you want to have a successful product, you have to have good packaging, but it wasn't just about having good packaging for me. It was much more about, that human aspect to it, that it's not just about selling you something, it's about getting joy out of life and appreciating what we have and the resources that we have around us and admiring and having gratitude for the talent that surrounds us and being able to be a part of this whole story of of the borough, contribute something to it, and maybe give back to it a little bit, you know. And that's really what all of my winemaking is about for me. It's about sending out a positive message, and it's about sharing joy. You know, I put that passion in everything that I do, into all the wines that I make.
I would say food progression kind of turned into a different stride maybe 15 years ago, where you went away from sticking to all the traditional techniques and all the traditional forms and the layout of a restaurant to creating it in your own way and creating nouveau displays of foods.
Mm-hmm.
And you pretty much now with food, you can do whatever you want if you feel like you want to display it in something that replicates you.
Yeah,
do you think wine is going through that same progression, or are people accepting of it? Did they accept it when you started Brooklyn Enology?
Yes and no. You know, I certainly had some potential customers who kind of side wind to give it the side eye and go, you know, that looks gimmicky. And then other people who are all on board with the idea. And I can certainly see both sides, you know, both sides of opinion there.
Because I'm sure there's so many people who just only know about old world wines.
Yeah, and people love classic. You know, of course, when a wine says Brooklyn on it, you wonder where the water came from, of course.
Yeah, hopefully not Gowanus.
Right. You know, of course, where are you growing the grapes? And I said, assure you, not in the empty lot next door, you know. You know, but I think once people understood the story, you know, I had to get really good at developing that 15-second pitch, you know, to get out the little blurb,
yeah.
to get people to understand what it was about. But I think once people saw that, you know, I wasn't just trying to make a hot buck, that I was really serious about my craft, and then people understood what the intention was. And yes, I do think that wine and beers and really all of the craft beverage movement is moving in this direction where you can play and it be perfectly acceptable as a quality product. Because isn't that the whole idea, is to create, you know? And if it's not about self-expression, well, then it's just about repetition. And to me, that doesn't seem very exciting. So, you know, to do something with your own little tweak and twist on it, yeah, that's...
And you must be very proud to go back to Long Island and to be able to produce something from the land there.
Yeah, well, now I am. Yeah, I don't know if I was always enthusiastic about that, but that's a whole other... that's a whole other thing. But, yeah, I really love my community on the North Fork, you know, and it's a different...
It's brimming with wineries now.
It's brimming, yeah. And there's that sense of community and partnership between the players in the agricultural and the hospitality industries out there. So it's not just partnership between wineries. It's between the wineries and the breweries and the distilleries and the restaurants and the B&Bs and the chicken farmers and the vegetable growers and everybody who's really interested in making it a vibrant community that is passionate about providing good quality food with low impact on the environment, and we all do business together and do business with each other. It's fascinating. It's really fascinating to see how, you know, this everyday ritual that we have of eating and drinking can really build a strong community, and not just in the spiritual sense, but also in the economic sense.
I just want to go back to the topic of being humane, because I went to your wine launch last week.
Yeah.
And I went in there and it was in a lovely setting on the Lancy, and there was some live music and there was some bread and there were some cured meats, and you were standing there behind the wines at the table. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this looks great. And then I got a piece of paper with the wines listed on it. And I was blown away, because I had never seen that kind of approach to wine. You know, how you would name the wines, the story that you had behind the wine. You know, you going back to the humane approach, can you just tell us a bit about Asif, the recent wines that you've just launched?
Yeah, it was great to see you at that launch too. Thanks, yeah. Yeah, so the Asif wines are a new project. So that launch you were at was sort of the official debuting. I had bottled the white and rosé last year and had done just a soft launch and started selling them in the tasting room, but I was waiting for the red to be mature and ready to do the official release of everything. And those wines are really... I wanted to do something on a more personal level that expressed my gratitude for how I came to be at this point in my life, for not only having figured out what it is that I love to do on a day-to-day basis, but figuring that out is difficult in and of by itself. And then having the opportunity to even do anything about it to the chance to pursue that, that's a huge gift from the universe. And becoming a winemaker and building a business and completely switching career paths and forging this whole new destiny for myself was a huge lesson in learning who I am and what I'm good at, what I'm not good at. And so these three wines, I wanted to be sort of the core message of what I think that anybody could take away from feeling lucky in life. So the white I named Serendipity. And Serendipity is, I gave each of the wines a little like tagline too. So Serendipity is the delivery of opportunity to one ready to receive it. Because opportunity can come, but if you don't recognize it, you're not capable or not quite ready to be able to identify it, then it comes and it goes. But when you are open to seeing something, then you see it, and then you can do something with it. You can grab onto it.
I'm in total agreement with that.
Yeah. You know, so it's more than just chance or luck. Yeah. It's also, you know, being in that frame of mind where you say, oh, I can do something with that. But then it takes courage, which is the rosé, to begin that journey. And because you can see an opportunity and say to yourself, oh, I don't know, what if this goes wrong? And what if that happens? And, you know, and you can start second guessing yourself or maybe get caught up in the idea of all the risk involved. But there's just as much risk in doing as there is in not doing. And so courage, I call the undaunted heart of action. And so it's when you really have to pick yourself up by the bootstraps, grab onto your vision, and pick somewhere and start to say, go. And thereafter, it requires a lot of persistence, which is the red. So, and persistence is to tenaciously challenge opposition in pursuit of a vision. And as we all know in this business, it has a lot of highs and has many lows, and you have to ride out a lot, and it's challenging work and it's continuous work, but it can be extraordinarily rewarding, and it takes that drive and that push and reaching deep down inside of yourself over and over and over and over again. And this can be said really for anything that anybody wants to do in life. You know, it's, and for me, this serendipity, courage, and persistence are touchstones and values that I go back to with myself almost on a daily basis now. You know, now that I've identified what these things are, it's when I come to a difficult point, you know, I need to go back and refer to these three things to remind myself that, you know, we have these three gifts. And that if you, the message behind these wines is, if there's something that's out there that you really dream about and you really want to do, you can. And it's not simple and it's not easy and it doesn't necessarily boil down to three words, but there are those little touchstones from which you can gain some strength and start somewhere.
That's amazing. I think it gives so much more strength by approaching wine like that to food and wine than it does to simply saying, this is a grape and it was aged and it came from this region and the soil is rich and great. Taste it.
Yeah.
You know, by giving it a story like that, similar to trying a dish of food and knowing that it came from the chef's grandmother's tradition from a region that she was from in Europe, and now the chef is living in a part of Brooklyn and the chef has developed it. It's the same kind of thing, you know, and it's an ability to relate to it.
Yeah. It's the story of why. You know, because, and I don't want this to sound, well, anyway, I'll just say it. You know, anyone could choose to make a plate of spaghetti or, you know, to ferment some grapes or what have you. Not to make it sound small or anything like that. It's the whole reason, the drive, and that's what these stories are. It's the why did you decide to pick those grapes? Why did you decide to give that care and thought into these things? You know, because it's coming from somewhere where you feel love and gratitude. And food and beverage at the end of the day is about sharing with one another. And if we can do that through such a simple ritual and show each other how much we appreciate being in this world and being as a part of each other's world, that kind of makes the world go round, I think.
So this is a an industry that you're in love with. You love it.
I fall in love with it over and over again. Yes, it has taught me so much. It has really taught me so much.
Has it been easy? Because it's a topic that comes up all the time. Ladies in the hospitality industry, being in food, they don't get it easy. I'm sure the same goes across the board in wine.
Yeah, and having worked in as both a winemaker, but also in technical work, you know, as an engineer, there continues to be challenges. So, you know, I've been working professionally for 20 years in one capacity or another, and even before that, you know, I had plenty of high school jobs and college jobs and things like that. And certainly things have changed. And I feel really lucky that I was born at a time where the feminist movement was really starting to become a real strong thing. I shouldn't say become a real strong thing. It was a very strong part of life, of culture. And it's moved a lot of things for a lot of women. And most importantly, women have come to support each other that much more. Used to have to fight for your space, but now I find so much more that women create space for each other. And even so, lots of men create space for women as well. But that isn't the case across the board. There's still a lot of...
In your industry, though, it's still very male-dominated, is it?
It's still male-dominated, but holy cow, the changes in the last 10 years and the number of women that I know that are either in production or in a high-level job in the industry in some form or another, or just simply the number of women at all working in the local wine industry has dramatically increased, dramatically. And it's really exciting. And for the most part, I see support. And, you know, the difficulty with men and women in the workplace together, it's not difficulty between them, but the signs of where there's still resistance to women, they're so very subtle and can be so hard to recognize because it's... People know it's not PC to be outwardly sexist. And so there's been semantics and language that's been developed, you know, and I didn't really realize it myself. You know, maybe if you had asked me this question 5 years ago, I might have said, oh, yeah, you know, it seems like everything's really equal now and there's almost no work to be done. But over the last 5 years, as I've gotten further along into running my company, I hear things from time to time as I conduct my business on any given day that... Some men say things differently to me than they would say it to me if I were a man approaching them with my product. And, you know, it started to dawn on me a few years ago going, well, that was weird. And walking away from meetings going, why do I feel like I just got treated like a little girl right now?
And then the penny drops in your realm.
Yeah. And then I started to recognize, you know, and so these little things. So it's a little bit harder sometimes to see, but it's really there. It's really there.
We have ladies like Cherry Bomb, you know, just on here on air before us who are definitely changing the tide, and women are getting more of a voice on across the board within all industries. I suppose we're focusing on hospitality here, and that's what Cherry Bomb focuses on. But organizations like that certainly. Yeah. Push the boat out a little bit further and make their voices a little bit louder.
The good news is that women are offering each other a lot of support. There's a lot of terrific forums. One that I joined recently was the Tokelist Society Facebook group, and it's all women in the food and beverage industry on it. And it's a lot of just networking, but I mean, to see the huge number of members of this group, you go, holy smokes, you know.
It must be pretty inspiring.
It is. It is really inspiring. And I have a couple of girlfriends. We call each other WWGSD, which stands for Women Who Get Stuff Done.
Ooh!
Yeah. Stuff is a different word, but I can't say on the air. But, but you know, it's like, yeah, get out there. You know, and the good news is we have each other. We have each other to rely on. But also good news is that we've got a lot of men out there who are really rooting for us as well. And I hope that tradition continues. As long as we continue to pass those values down to the next generation, it can only get better. You know, what another person with whom I recently did an interview, they asked, you know, what do you see for the future? And I said, you know, I would love to see a future where this isn't even a question. you know, where my biology really has nothing to do with it, you know, because all everything I've done has come out of my head, not out of any other of my body parts.
That's a very good point, yeah.
Yes.
Kind of puts it in perspective,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Right. It's all come out of my brain. So,
Ali, just before we leave, I want to ask you, what has the food and wine industry given you before you ever got into it?
It's given me myself, most of all.
Yeah. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's shown me who I am. It's enabled me to find joy, to learn so many things about Zen and rolling with it, and also learning how to do things really well, let go of perfection. Still working on that, and to really reach parts of myself that I didn't know were there.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ali. You've been a wonderful guest on Why Food. You've certainly embodied the story of one industry fits all, which is what we're trying to express, that by putting the effort and putting your soul behind something, you can do anything in the food and drink industry.
It has been all my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And I'd like to extend my thanks to the wonderful people at Heritage Radio Network for giving the industry an incredible platform to communicate and engage. If you want to listen to more shows or learn more about the network, please visit heritageradionetwork.org. I want to thank the great David Tadashore for producing today's show. If you want to get in touch, you can do so by emailing whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. I'm constantly trying to find more and more interesting people who have made the transition from a past career into the food industry. So if you know of anybody, please do get in touch. If you enjoyed today's show, please do rate it and review it on iTunes and Stitcher. Next week, I'll be chatting to Timothy Casper, previously a teacher, who is now the head chef at the wonderful Pasquale Jones. One industry fits all. Thanks very much for listening, guys.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.